Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. Americans seem hopelessly divided. We have Democrats versus Republicans, whites versus blacks and other people of color, Christians versus Muslims and Jews. Long-standing divisions have intensified with the widespread use of social media and with Trump and Russia fanning the flames of disinformation and division. How can we heal the divisions and bring the country together? Our guest today has answers to this important question. Nathan Bomey is a reporter for USA Today. He wrote a book 3 years ago called After the Fact about the erosion of truth in US politics. After writing the book, he was deeply concerned about America's polarization. So Nathan began looking for ways to address our divides, traveling the country to meet those dedicated to bringing people together. He writes the stories of these people and their programs to bring people together in a new book just out called Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. He paints a portrait of Americans who are bridging our divides. Their stories offer us guidance for a nation in desperate need of reconciliation. The book shows how everyone can get involved in bringing people together across differences so we can address really big challenges like climate change and the pandemic. Nathan Bomey, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I love your book. I'm encouraging all our readers to read it. It's called Bridge Builders. Could you explain why did you write this book?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of laid it out. You know, I, as a national journalist, you know, I'm immersed every day in the crisis of misinformation that surrounds us. You know, as a journalist, you dedicate your life to the truth. You dedicate your life to validating the facts, to authenticating sources, and you feel like you're doing a responsible job of trying to communicate with the public and, you know, be fair to everyone involved. And so that's one thing. And then you see sort of how we have been attacked and you see how much division and hate is out there. And then also just studying it for my second book, you know, realizing how deeply divided we are, how much we are truly surrounded by this toxic environment. You know, I said, I've got to go out and meet people who aren't accepting the status quo, you know, people who are trying to bring others together despite their differences, whether it's politics, race, religion, class, or culture. You know, this is basically, it sounds simple, but it's the most complex and bedeviling challenges of our time. But I think we can't afford not to try to figure this out because we are in this together.
Exactly right. And, you know, you're facing this every day as a journalist at USA Today and the research you've done on your books. But I love the quote you drew from President John F. Kennedy, and I'm from Massachusetts, so that's a real favorite of ours. But and Kennedy says, united, there is little we cannot do. Divided, there is little we can do. How crippling do you think the current divisions are in our country?
Well, they are crippling. And I think that quote was remarkably prescient for our time as well. But if you look at when Kennedy said that, that was during the first, you know, his inaugural address, 1961. And, you know, he actually was addressing some of the major issues of the time, including the need to inject life into the economy, the need to deal with disease. He actually talks about the international disease, or what does that make you think of, right?
Right. I mean,
and international disputes that they were facing at the time. Now, we may not be on the verge of a potential nuclear war, but it kind of feels like we're on the verge of some sort of massive fission in this country. And so, mm-hmm. So I think that those words still resonate today. And, you know, I mean, the way I look at it is, you know, we are sort of all in this together in the sense that, you know, Dr. King said, we are sort of all in this inescapable web of mutuality, you know, and I think that that is why we can't afford to sort of allow this to fester? Because one of the interesting questions I've gotten after the, you know, as I've been, you know, talking to people about this book, it's a lot of people who say, like, why do we really need to address this? People who are skeptical tackle toxic polarization. And I just say, well, because if you haven't looked, I mean, our system is built based on the need to work together. I mean, we have a two-party system that basically is predicated on, if we don't try to find some ways to collaborate and if we don't want to find some common ground, then we won't be able to address some of the major issues that really are we face during this time.
Absolutely. You know, whatever issue is most important to you, this issue of working together preempts them all, because we need to be pulling together and working together versus our problems instead of attacking each other. And you've looked very deeply at this question, so I'm curious to know what your analysis is of why do you think so many Americans are so divided now?
Well, I mean, I think it's really an incredibly complex confluence of factors that, you know, really dates back decades, if not centuries. And I mean, I certainly think that we can point to the Trump administration and the 4 years of that administration as having accelerated many of the divides. But if you look at the Pew Research Center data, before Trump even came into office, our divides were wider than ever. So, you know, and this is sort of a gradual journey toward what political scientists called affective polarization, which is essentially that you're not just disagreeing on the issues, you are disrespecting each other's humanity. That we, you know, you and I may disagree, we may see things differently, but if we can't even acknowledge that the other person has a fundamental humanity, then that illustrates the depths of our crisis. And so, you know, when I talk to a group called Braver Angels, which is teach people how to talk to each other again, very simple things, I said, you know, what's the goal here? Isn't the goal sort of to get people on the same page, to get them to agree? And David Blankenhorn, the co-founder of Braver Angels, said, the goal is actually not to get people to agree. He said, I don't care necessarily if they come, you know, to some sort of common ground on policy issues. Yeah, that's maybe the goal in the long run, but in the short run, the goal is to reestablish what he called social trust, which is this idea that I can see in you, then, you know, a human and someone who I respect, and I understand that our destinies are interwoven with each other. You know, Valerie Kaur, the Sikh civil rights activist, in her recent book, See No Stranger, put it like this. She said, you are a part of me I do not yet know, in the sense that, you know, if I can sit here and think that I don't need you, but the reality is that actually our journeys are in tandem with each other.
That's so true. There's actually, that reminds me of an old Irish expression, which is, there's no such thing as a stranger, only a friend you have not yet met.
I like that.
So you could weave that in there somewhere. I have to admit, I was a little skeptical reading the book because, you know, I live here in Washington, D.C. I know you're in this area, and we see every day just the pounding. And I just had a guest on my show recently who wrote a book on Confederate monuments, and her subtitle is basically, there is no common ground. The reason being, from, you know, there is a group of people who actually deals in reality in politics, and then there's a group that lives in a fantasy land. I mean, if people buy into the big lie of Trump about the election was stolen by Joe Biden last year and all that is wrapped around, there's really, it's hard to find common ground with someone who's living in a surreal world based on lies. So how do you respond to that challenge?
Yeah, no, I think it's a really important question. I think the first thing that we have to say is that we do face a potentially intractable problem, in the sense that the crisis of misinformation is very challenging. And, you know, we can't underestimate, this may be the challenge of our time in one way. And so I don't think this is something that we can fix overnight or anything like that. But I would say this, that, you know, first off, bridge builders don't accept intolerance. They don't accept hate. There's never room for that. So we have to say that up front. So with something like Confederate monuments, they're not trying to find some sort of compromise and that sort of thing. But, you know, but there are going to be a lot more issues than I think we want to admit, where there may be some common ground, or there may be somewhere we can actually start to have a discussion. The way I would look at it is this. You know, if you are watching, if you're at a stadium or an arena and you're watching a game, and, you know, I see the play unfold in a certain way where the, you know, I see the way that the call is made, the call the referee makes. And to me, it looks clear. I know what I saw. I saw the facts. And, you know, I can't really be convinced otherwise. But if you actually go, the reality is, if you're sitting in that stadium with 100,000 people, there are 99,900 slightly different or potentially significantly different perspective than you on the same play that played out on the field. Mm-hmm. And not that the play isn't any different. The fact is, they may have seen something you didn't see, or perhaps you saw something that they didn't see. And so how do we address it? Well, I think that it starts with going to the other side of the stadium and coming shoulder to shoulder with the person who saw things just a little bit differently and saying, show me what you saw. And then I will show you what I saw. And I think those types of relationships between people of difference, you know, between people who pray differently, look differently, think differently, are the way that we can start to overcome this vast dispute over the facts.
Right. I think that's a great analogy. And I happen to be a huge baseball fan. In fact, I'm the governor of Red Sox Nation. So
excellent. Okay.
We know that the umpires are always right when it's called in our favor, and they're always wrong when it's called in favor of the Yankees. So I think that's true. We do definitely have different perspectives. I'm only hoping, you know, I can see in every other domain, if you're talking about the racial issue with the whites versus blacks, or you're talking about the religious issue, I'm really understanding the different one. All of them, which you have a great number of fabulous examples, I think it's absolutely fantastic. I do think the hardest one to grapple with is the fact that, you know, something like a third of the people in the United States actually believe lies and make decisions based on those lies. So I'm hoping maybe some of these personal connections, if we make more of them, can just help people understand that, help Republicans understand that Democrats aren't evil demons that engage in pedophilia. Yeah. But actually, we're real human beings who are patriotic and love America. And maybe when they see that, they could, maybe then some of the light could shine on the truth around our elections. Is that what you're hoping?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is also important to say that there's no room for false equivalence from a moral perspective, in the sense that, yes, sometimes one side is right and the other side is wrong. And that's why it's interesting that I actually had the chance to speak to some real life bridge builders for this book, people like contractors and engineers who design and build bridges. And they actually said, you know what, actually, we don't always build the bridge to meet squarely in the middle. They sometimes build the bridge from one side of the ravine to the other side of the ravine, which is so interesting to me. And that suggests to me, and I think that's the case with metaphorical bridge builders, is that we don't always expect to meet in the middle, because sometimes there is no middle ground. You know, we have to bring them over to our side. But that doesn't mean that we should be excused from the desire, the need to build those bridges. You know, I think that that's really important. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with something like the 2020 election, you know, Donald Trump lost the election. There's no room for dispute on that sort of thing. But I would say that I would caution against getting too much despair over what you see in the polls today, because what we have seen over time in America is that people do often tend to eventually come around to a realization that, you know, the facts are the facts, or they come around to a realization that they might have been wrong. They can change. If you look at an issue like same-sex marriage, for example, in 2004, the percent of Americans who supported it, 31%, less than a third. By 2019, only 15 years later, it was up to 61%. So it went up from 31 to 61 over the course of only 15 years. That's a contentious social issue. If I told you in 2004, 30% of Americans are going to completely change their mind on that topic and only continuing to increase, then you would have said, I can't believe that. The point being, relationships in a lot of ways actually do make the difference. I think in that particular issue, a lot of people changed their mind because they actually found out they knew someone in the LGBTQ community and that their lives were affected by this public policy. So I think relationships often are the first way we can start to try to convince people that maybe they're wrong.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's interesting you talk in the book that facts won't change minds, but relationships can change minds. It reminds me of some of the work being done on framing. Like, if you've got a frame that you believe Trump is the savior of America, then all the facts anybody says to you will bounce off the frame.
Yeah.
And the only way to change the internal thinking on a frame is through relationship and through, you know, asking questions that you begin to kind of think in some other ways. So, yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that Braver Angels program. That was just so moving when you described what they do.
Yeah, well, and let me just add too, before I get to that, that it is painful for me as a journalist to write a sentence like, the facts often aren't enough, you know, because I feel like they should be. But I have to come to the difficult realization that for a lot of people, it's not, because of what you said, the fact that we live in a tribalistic society in which oftentimes the camp that you're in matters more than, you know, than the truth that's out there, in the sense that I don't want to alienate myself from the people who I have relationships with. And therefore, I'm going to reject the facts if they come into contrast with my value set, which is why I think you're right about framing, that it's so critical for us to think very strategically about how we frame the issues. And a lot of times that's actually all you need to do. Mm-hmm. Like, I met someone named Bob Inglis for this book, who is a former congressman, former Republican congressman from South Carolina, conservative Christian, one of the most conservative districts in the country. And he has become a very vocal advocate for the need to do something significant about climate change. And he is trying to reach his fellow conservative, often Christian conservatives, by just using different framing, different sort of phrasing in a lot of ways, and saying, you know, to conservatives, you don't have to change your values to embrace the need to take action on climate change. Actually, the action in climate change fits within your values. Let me explain to you. And he'll do things like, and talk about the traditional conservative mentality on things like personal accountability, for example, and just all kinds of interesting strategies that he takes, because he is a conservative and knows how to reach them. And so but there's data out there that shows that there are oftentimes people on both sides of the fence, but here I'm speaking particularly of progressives, who say that they are not willing to change the way they speak about issues, even if they know that it would work better if they did. So it's like, we kind of have to distance ourselves from some of maybe the phrases we use, if like the end objective is good in the end, you know, like if the word you use about climate change isn't working, you know, choose a different phrase. And because the planet matters more than anything.
I think that's such an important point. And I love that story. That was one of my favorite parts of your book, about the conservative Republican member of Congress who was a climate denier.
Yeah.
Turned around to become a climate activist. And yes, he's like going out as an evangelical, trying to convince Republicans to take action about climate. And talk a little bit about, it's exactly what you mentioned. It was relationship. It was two relationships that were very significant to him, yeah, that had him change his thinking. And then it was his framing of the message that's been helping to bring more Republicans into climate action. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was pretty inspiring to hear him talk about it, because in the 1990s, Bob Inglis was, you know, just about as conservative as you get in the Newt Gingrich wing of the Republican Party, and support, you know, vocally against Al Gore, advocating climate change action already at that point. And, you know, he told me that there was two relationships in particular that really started to change his mind. One was his own son, you know, had been at that point 18 years old, saying, "Dad, look, here, you have to do something. My generation is going to be affected if you don't. And how can you not listen to your son when he says that sort of thing?" Mm-hmm. And then secondly, an Australian climate scientist who he met actually on a congressional fact-finding trip to Australia, where they basically went down and snorkeled the Great Barrier Reef and saw the destruction that's happening there due to climate change. And he, in this Australian climate scientist, is a Christian and explained to Bob how he doesn't necessarily worship the corals. Like, it's not earth worship. He said, I don't believe in climate change in the same way that I believe in God. I just believe that in the facts, I trust the science, and the two can coexist. And once he sort of explained to Bob Inglis that, listen, we are here to be stewards of God's creation, then he kind of pointed him to some different verses that a lot of Christians tend to ignore. I thought that that was really compelling. And so, again, it comes back to, you know, trying to leverage those types of relationships, because often there are going to be people who are sort of on the edge, on the fringe of their group. You know, not everyone is a fully devoted member of whatever group you may consider to be radical. A lot of times there's people on the fringe who they are a little more receptive, and you might be able to reach them, and then they may be able to reach some of the other people.
Absolutely. And this congressman is now reaching so many Republicans because of those two relationships, and because they were willing to talk to him and talk, you know, in a way that he can hear. And I love that he says, you know, if you want to get more Republicans, you don't talk about sacrifice and shrinking or anything applies kind of going backwards or cutting,
right?
You know, talk about the job opportunities, the business opportunity, which I found fascinating, is that I wrote a piece in the Boston Business Journal in 1990, all about that, this whole need to redesign and recreate everything that we do, whether it's cars or buildings. Everything has to be designed in a new way and built in a new way to reduce emissions and get the carbon out of the air. And that is the greatest job and business creation opportunity in the history of humanity. We're talking about multi-trillions of dollars to be made in this renewable energy carbon-free economy, and that is still true. But I haven't heard a lot of environmentalists pick up that. I think we could, you know, engage a lot more people.
Well, you were way ahead of yourself. You were writing about that in 1990. I mean, that is impressive. And, you know, yeah, I think that with the way Bob Inglis talks about it as opportunity, you know, and he views climate change actually as something that could ultimately help Americans sort of bridge some other divides, which I found so interesting. He pointed to a very obscure but pretty interesting Ronald Reagan quote from the 80s, where he actually says to Gorbachev in a private meeting, you know, when in the midst of the Cold War, he says, you know, if aliens attack the world, I'm pretty sure we would find a way to work together. And that would be some sort of ridiculous existential threat to humanity. You know, now we actually are facing an existential threat to this planet. And so if we can figure out a way to tackle it together, maybe it does pave the way for starting to bridge some other divides.
I think that would be great. And by the way, I wouldn't dismiss the alien thing. We're getting that report from the Pentagon next month.
UFOs.
Now they're calling them UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon.
You know, listen, with how strange everything's been going the last 16 months, that would be quite the capper to find out that we're not here alone. So.
Right, exactly. Stay tuned on that. We'll do another show on that topic. You know, we're just at the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's death at the hands of the police in Minneapolis. And this, you know, brought to light, I was just, obviously the world was appalled to see how he was killed. Yeah. And yet the response has been so inspiring, really, that so many people, even in the middle of a pandemic, just went out into the streets and said, that's wrong, it's got to change. And it seems to finally we've hit a critical mass, or maybe it was that video that was so visual. people are really thinking about this issue of racial justice and what can I do personally? What can we do as a society? Which program of all that you have worked at do you think is effective at building bridges across the racial divide?
Well, I had the opportunity with a group called Coming to the Table, which actually has established several dozen chapters throughout the country where they are actually bringing people together, namely Black Americans and white Americans, but really anybody, to talk about the legacy of slavery. And it's such a dynamic group because actually a good portion of their board members are descended from people who were enslaved. And then a good portion of their board members are descended from people who were enslavers, and that just sort of illustrates what they're committed to, which is a conversation about where we're not going to pretend like, you know, that the past didn't happen. You know, I think that bridge builders acknowledge the past, they acknowledge the truth, they're not going to paper over the past, and Coming to the Table doesn't do that. You know, they sit down, but what they focus on is listening, and I find that so interesting. You know, and I was had the opportunity to go attend a group. It was about a dozen people in Annapolis, Maryland, near us. And they, what they do is they do sort of a circle discussion group based on the principles of restorative justice, which is roots in the indigenous communities, that said, you know, we are going to focus on listening to other people. Essentially, they hand a rock from person to person. If you don't have the rock, you can't talk. You have to listen. And I have to tell you, it was very strange to sit there and do that because we are used to a speak first, listen second culture. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Bridge builders actually listen first and speak second. And not because they don't have something to say, but because they believe that if they can't show the other person that they're invested in their story, that they see, that oftentimes they won't engage, because a lot of people just want to know that you see them, that you understand who they are, or you respect their humanity. So oddly enough, one of the biggest goals of listening is actually to be heard. You know, now we're not talking about hate or exclusion. We're never going to listen to those things. You know, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is where there is some room for perspective. And and a lot of times we, and I can say this as a white man, we as white Americans have not listened for so long. And it is time for us to start listening, you know, and then to use our voices to speak up where we haven't before. So it is a dichotomy where you can't have one without the other, but listening first oftentimes is the only way to build bridges. And I think this is another example of where we can't expect Black Americans to build bridges toward us. You know, if you're a white person, yeah, you may feel like you're not responsible for, you know, things that have happened in the past, but ultimately, because we are white, we benefit from this legacy. And so we have to acknowledge that there are ways in which we need to be engaged in this conversation. And so Coming to the Table provides a space where people can actually have that conversation, but primarily do the listening.
And listening is so underrated, I think. You know, it can really diffuse a lot of situations.
It can.
So I love that. And, you know, you had mentioned before about the misinformation that's being pumped out. I personally am very concerned about the Russians and the role they're playing in all of this. In fact, Facebook just came out in today's paper saying the Russians are the biggest source of misinformation in social media. So yeah, they are deliberately trying to sow confusion and misunderstanding. But, you know, we have the fault lines in our own society for sure, but they're just blowing them up.
Yeah.
So misinformation is definitely a big problem. And you talk about a great approach in your book about how there's a program that teaches people how to discern fact from fiction so that we're not so susceptible. You know, when we get something come across our Facebook, we go, oh, that's interesting. Don't even read it. We just pump it across and share it. But that actually to kind of slow that down, to read things and to check first to see if it's factual before spreading it. Talk a little bit about that MediaWise program you wrote about.
Yeah, it's really important, I think. And I can say as a professional journalist that I think that we really need to start to teach Americans how to actually deploy the basic principles of journalism, which is questioning the sources that you're looking at and kind of cross authenticating them, you know, looking for other sources to authenticate information, because we can't unfortunately expect the media to always be there to do it for people, because we as an industry have been so diminished over time by financial crisis that oftentimes people don't have a credible source to check. So they're the only one. I mean, there's a credible source, but it may not be. And so we have to figure out how to actually start to train people on how to do this themselves. And I think it probably starts with education. You know, I think if let's say adults are a lost cause, you know, I think maybe we can agree that kids aren't, you know, and that students can, they're still in a formative place where they're learning how to grapple with social media, for example. And I agree with you about the Russians, you know, it's extremely disquieting. And what it just demonstrates is that we would do a lot better if we start to train ourselves on you know, trying to immediately second guess and question whatever we see online, you know, especially as we get deeper into a society in which we're going to have deep fakes and we're going to have all kinds of things that'll make you question what you see and hear. We can't afford to get in a situation where you can't trust anything. And so, you know, so we have to help people navigate. And I think Americans do deserve a degree of grace in the sense of what they're dealing with here, because we haven't equipped most people with the skills to be able to deal with this kind of thing. Who among us hasn't, you know, read a story and realized later it was false in some capacity? So it happens to all of us, just a matter of what scale. And so, you know, but yeah, you're right. With George Floyd movement, for example, there is plenty of evidence that Russian sources were trying to exacerbate tensions on that topic and trying to get Americans to be divided. And so in some ways that's bizarrely encouraging, because it suggests that a lot of the hate out there was actually artificial. But the problem is that it has a real world impact. So I agree, it's important for us to start to invest in this kind of, you know, training. Now, a lot of people call it news literacy. You know, you call it what you want, but it's very important.
Oh, and you mentioned news literacy. There is this news literacy project that you write about, training educators to teach middle schoolers and high schoolers how to separate fact from fiction. So if we can make it to the next generation, maybe there's some hope there. But I wouldn't give up on anybody. And the fact that they're adding in some of the people 50 plus in the training is also good. So listeners, if you're curious at all about these trainings on fact or fiction, where would they go to learn more about how to do that training?
Yeah, you can Google MediaWise, one word, or the News Literacy Project. Actually, MediaWise is partnered with AARP, and they're actually trying to work with AARP to get the word out there. So when you got tens of millions of members, that's a good place to start. You know, I think a lot of seniors, you know, yes, the data shows maybe more susceptible to falling for misinformation. But the way that their trainers actually begin at MediaWise is not by saying, you may have fallen prey to some fake news regarding Donald Trump or something like that. They actually start with something that we all can address as a problem, like online scams. Okay, we all know that online scams are out there. How do we identify those? Mm-hmm. Then you start with that skill and then you build from there and say, okay, well, what other things might there be deception intentionally so or inaccidentally so? And how can we identify that? And so I think they have a very sophisticated approach. And I think you'll find that the majority of Americans really do want to be able to figure out what's true online. I mean, yes, there are bad actors out there, but the data shows, the research shows that people know misinformation is a crisis, just that a lot of us don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, so that's great. You've got those programs, MediaWise, to address that. Now, you mentioned about the challenges in journalism now, which is a very big issue. I mean, that's part of why we're in the mess we're in, is that as traditional media is now collapsing, there's not the financing, there's not the revenue for the newspapers or even the television news, and that void is being filled. You know, I'm reading data showing most younger people get most of their news out of social media, where there is no kind of professional sieve saying this is fact, this is fiction. Right. So a couple of questions around journalism. What role do you think professional journalists like you need to play in this whole approach for bridge building among Americans?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I didn't want to write a book about how other people need to follow these standards on how to bring people together without training the lens on myself as a journalist. I think that, unfortunately, a lot of times, those of us in the media tend to think we are sort of not part of this conversation, that we are somehow unemotional, unobjective observers of the situation, and that we don't have a role to play. But I have to reject that and say we have a powerful platform, and we have very important choices to make every day that do decide the how people interact, the kind of conversation, the tone that we set, I think matters a lot. And so, you know, but I do think that the best to reestablish trust between Americans and the media is probably on a local level. You know, I think the demise of local journalism in particular is really a fundamentally just unbelievably significant damage to the relationship between people and the media. Because if you don't know a journalist, then how can you be expected to trust a journalist? You know, if there's no journalist in your hometown, again, going back to relationships, you don't actually have a relationship with a journalist, then the media seems a lot more foreign to you and sound like someone who's not in your camp, someone who you can't trust. So I met a group called 100 Days in Appalachia, which is a group of Appalachian journalists who are basically doing very local, you know, grassroots nonprofit journalism, trying to tell authentic stories about the people of Appalachia, a much more complex region than those of us in the national press have given it credit for. And they're saying, listen, you can trust us as journalists to tell your stories. We're not going to paper over the challenges. We're not going to ignore a lot of the real huge faults of the area, but we are going to say, you know, there's diversity in this area. You know, we have LGBTQ people in Appalachia. We have Muslim people in Appalachia. We have people who have a story to tell. And so I find that to be one small way in which we can start to address this. And then in terms of myself as a journalist, national journalist, how can I make decisions that actually start to kind of de-escalate this hyper-sensationalization of the news? You know, like the fact that unfortunately so many of us are tempted often to chase after ratings, chase after page views. I think Americans, that does have an effect. Even if what we're reporting is fundamentally true, if the way we package it is just stretches things just a little bit, over time, that adds up and people start to lose trust. So we need to choose nuance over caricature. You know, I think that is the route back to reestablishing the trust.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I would add to that, you know, I've been looking at some of the surveys on what people think about media and journalists. And one of the things that the journalists think they're supposed to do is cover, you know, cover all the scandals. If it bleeds, it leads. And, you know, the problems that are out there, the exposés. But actually, people are feeling besieged. You know, we know things are bad and people don't want to feel worse. But, you know, reading and watching a lot of the traditional media just makes you feel worse. So people are kind of tuning out in droves.
Yeah.
Whereas it's always seemed to me we need much more emphasis on the kinds of things you've written your books about, including this book, which is what's positive. What are some of the models out there? Like the, you know, the 100 Days in Appalachia, just some of the more positive, like what's it going to take to get newspapers to do something more positive? Do they think that just doesn't sell, or how do we get more of that in there?
Yeah, I think, you know, I couldn't agree more. And I think what we need is more emphasis on solutions and just a little bit less on pure abject conflict. You know, I think I've often been asked, and I'm sure you have, journalists, young people will say, you know, isn't there a bias in journalism toward one side or the other? And I say, really, the bias in journalism is toward conflict, in the sense that that is what we as journalists always want. And it's sort of like rooted deep down. And yeah, because conflict is news. I mean, that is true. We're not going to stop covering conflict. That's not going to happen. But I do think that we can, the way we frame it, the way we approach it, can be more solutions oriented in the sense that we can point people toward how are some people trying to address this instead of just leaving it at the, throwing the problem out there and then leaving it at that. There are ways we can actually start to say, no, there are people who've thought thoughtfully about this issue. And I actually look at a publication called the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is actually owned by Gannett, owns my employer, just full disclosure. They actually stopped doing most of their sort of hot take op-ed type of stories and actually started to say, we're going to put more, we're going to publish more, we're going to post more solutions-oriented content. And their traffic went through the roof, which I found so interesting, which what that suggests to me is exactly what you said, which is people have tuned out of the of this sort of cacophonous collision of opinions, you know, that they don't want to see people arguing anymore. We've had enough of that. You can put plenty of that on social media all day if you want. What are we as journalists going to do to try to swim against the grain? And I think that's actually a way for us to stand out. We can attract viewers and readers, which is what we need financially. So we can't ignore that. But I also think it would serve the public.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I'm a huge fan of solutions focus. I call myself a solutionary. And, yeah. And in fact, the title of my first book is Breakthrough Solutions, How to Improve Your Life and Change the World by Building on What Works. Love that. I spent about 20 years going around the country looking for breakthrough models in different areas for helping children with autism, dealing with people in prisons, you know, and coming up with major solutions that would transform their field. What surprised me when I was doing the research was just how many there are out there, but we don't hear about them because, you know, we're so conflict focused in the media, as you mentioned, we're not getting the oxygen and the visibility into the solutions that are already there. And I love your book because it's all about solutions to building bridges. And I encourage the readers, there's so much, we could spend hours just talking about the different programs that are out there working and building bridges. I want to move now to what you talk about at the end of the book is solutions at a national scale. That obviously we're in a crisis in this country. Some people think we're on the verge of a civil war. And, you know, January 6th insurrection at the Congress was not a good sign about where we're at. Talk some about your ideas that you've come up with and what you've found in your research about bringing solutions around bridge building to a national scale.
I do think this is really important because, you know, the book is mostly focused on grassroots efforts, people who are doing this on an individual to individual basis or on a sort of a community basis. But I think that we can draw lessons from them and apply it on a national scale. And so I tried to make a few sort of modest suggestions in the book, but I do think that sometimes the journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. And so, for example, I think they're all predicated on weaving a culture of relationship building into our institutions. And what I mean by that is, for example, number one, I think in schools, you know, we live in a Zoom era culture now. I think most kids are getting back to school, and that's obviously a good thing. But, you know, now we know that the remote, you know, Zoom style classrooms is actually very possible. So why can't we start to form sort of cross-district collaborations between students? You know, like, we unfortunately live in a very segregated society, segregated by race, by politics, by wealth, you know, certainly, of course, by geography, being the nature of segregation, urban versus rural, for example. So why can't we have urban students and rural students start to collaborate on class projects, on, say, social studies? They can learn from each other. Why can't we have kids from poor districts and wealthy districts collaborate together? You know, why can't we start to do sort of cross district collaborations that can actually be, you know, good from an educational standpoint and then also good from a societal standpoint? And one of my other suggestions is in college, you know, we see colleges that are being torn apart by differences on their campus. And, you know, a lot of times it's because students aren't listening to each other, insightful things. And it's incredibly difficult. Well, I looked at something very small, which is the fact that freshmen on college campuses often room with other freshmen who are just like them. Mm-hmm. And the colleges enable this. They allow them to pick other students who to be their roommates ahead of time. What happens is, and the Washington Post pointed this out, oftentimes, for example, the rich kids tend to find the rich kids, which means the white kids tend to find the white kids, you know, and mm-hmm. and how is that going to help us? You know, so there are a few universities that are starting to say, we're not going to allow freshmen to do that anymore. After your freshman year, you can room with whoever you want. But they actually try to room people together with different people, people who aren't like them. Now, okay, there are, you know, they can't put a night person with a morning person because, you know, there are some bridges that can never be, divides that can never be bridged. But I think that small things like that. And then lastly, I think public service is arguably one of the most compelling ways in which we can start to bring people together. Because when you are serving someone, then you're in that shoulder to shoulder relationship instead of face to face, which is so much more confrontational. You can serve other people. While you're doing it, you learn more about the person you're serving alongside of. You learn more about the person that you're serving, and you can make a big difference. You know, a group called the Interfaith Youth Corps, founded by Eboo Patel, is doing this. They're actually bringing together Muslims and evangelical Christians and Jewish students and other people of other faiths to actually do projects together. And then they learn about each other's faiths and realize, you know, we actually have a little bit more in common than we thought. So if you can bridge divides in public service on a local level, you can do it on a national level. There is a bipartisan proposal to triple the number of public service positions in this country, go up to 1 million positions that actually got approved under President Obama. It just hasn't been funded yet. So if they throw some funding at that, we could see a real revolution in this country.
Yeah, I think that's great. You know, and Obama had many things right, and that was one of them. You know, it's just amazing to me. It's such a great idea, and the country needs so much done with this public service. We could have the young people going out and fixing the trails. I mean, we're so far backlog in our national parks with all the work that needs to be done. There's a private group that does that, the Student Conservation Association. My daughter was involved with that on the Appalachian Trail. But I think you're right, this kind of a big scale, why not 1 million people in national service? I mean, why not everybody, really? I mean, why not make it so that every young person comes out and you're either doing military service or you're doing national service or you're doing Peace Corps, that, you know, you can have one of those three choices for your first year or two out of college.
Yeah, I know Pete Buttigieg has put together a proposal, something along those lines that suggests maybe we do look at that year of service after high school or college. And I think there is a lot of reason to think that that kind of thing might help, you know, and I think mandatory is probably never going to work because some people can't commit to that kind of thing. But, and it would be important to make sure it's inclusive, that, you know, people of color have the opportunity to do it as well. It doesn't just become a thing where you need money to do it, but details right, I think that something like that could really help a lot. And you know what's also interesting? The people who are being served oftentimes are the ones who change their minds too about the people who are serving them. I think about, you know, a group called the Iraqi and American Reconciliation Project, which I profiled in the book. And there was this group of Minneapolis people who just wanted to do something about the fact that they felt terrible about the American war in Iraq. So that after it kind of started to quiet down, they went to Najaf, Iraq. They started just planting trees, you know, very small thing. They were planting trees, contributing to water filters. And then there was these Iraqi people who saw them planting trees, formed these relationships with them. And now there's these international relationships that they are actually using to start to have conversations and have Iraqi and American people start to have a relationship that can maybe over time begin to heal some of those divides. I think it's such an interesting little example how one small spark can really turn into a very powerful fire in a good way.
Absolutely, because, you know, we've get these one-dimensional views of who the Iraqi people are. I mean, we think about Muslims or Arabs with the bombs under their vests, and the other side for them, they're looking at Americans and they just see this militaristic, bombs away, aggressive colonial power.
And if you think about it too, you know, the founder of that group, her father fought in World War II, and she talked about the sister cities program that America has. And this is actually what they've done with Iraq. The Minneapolis became the first city with an Iraqi city. But actually, if you look at post-World War II, that is actually a program we use to form relationships between the people of Japan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you had traveled back to the early 1940s and said that we would have as good of a relationship that we do with Japan now, and that we would have, you know, that Americans go to Tokyo and love Japanese culture, buy Japanese products, we've bridged a lot of those divides, those people would be shocked at you saying that. You know, the point is that we can address divides over time. We've done it before. And so, who knows, maybe 50 years from now, you know, America and Iraq have a profoundly different relationship because of the efforts of people like those in Minneapolis who are not accepting sort of the caricatured relationship and the caricatured description of the people of Iraq that we've endured for so long.
Right. Well, that was good news for America. We learned from the mistakes in winning World War One and then crushing the Germans that they then kind of rose up and had Hitler speak and boom. Yeah. So after World War II, the Americans came in and helped to rebuild Europe and rebuild Japan. So
yeah,
we got that piece right. And that helped build some very positive relationships, at least until Donald Trump was in the White House. But now in the White House, we have President Joe Biden, who I think is doing a great job. And I'm wondering, Nathan, you are so smart and you now have this incredible experience and knowledge about the country and these programs. Like, how do we address our biggest problem, which is pulling the country together? President Biden has said he wants to unite the country. And even if you don't vote for me, I'll be the president of you and I'll work for you too. Yeah. If you had 2 minutes with President Biden, what would you advise him to do to bring the country together?
Wow, what a question. That's such a great question. You know, I think that to your point, if you look at the data, you know, there is something in the order of 67% of Americans consist of what they call an exhausted majority, which is people who just want to see progress on the issues that they care about. I would say to President Biden that, you know, that the divide between Americans is not as wide as it appears, that we have a perception that we are incredibly divided, and perception is reality. So we are divided. But if you look at the issues, Americans actually agree a lot more on the issues than you might think. And so, for example, something like immigration, Republicans tend to think that Democrats are much more pro-immigration than they are, and Democrats tend to think Republicans are much more anti-immigration than they are. But the two camps just see each other in this incredibly demonized way. Mm-hmm. And of course, it extends to so many other issues. There are going to be issues where we're not going to agree, but there are a lot where we can agree. And I think I would say to any president that, you know, you should try to keep that in mind, that, you know, this, yeah, we live in a two-party system, but ultimately most Americans are in that exhausted majority.
Exactly right. And I, for years, have talked about kind of the 80-20, which is, I think most Americans agree 80% on 80% of things, or at least they used to. I'm not sure this is true now, kind of with Trump on the picture. But, you know, most things, most Americans kind of agree on. We want to have a good education for our kids. We want a good paying job. We want to retire in dignity. We want to be able to have health care for ourselves and our families if anybody gets sick. And we, you know, we need the child care and help family care to make sure that the children and the seniors and sick family members are taken care of. So we kind of pretty much all recognize we need and want that. Yeah. But that so much of the attention goes into the 20% that people just absolutely will not agree on. You know, and I would say reproductive rights is one of those. It's like big flashpoint. But and this is where I think, as much as I love professional journalism and the media, it's just played such a vital role in so many ways since the founding of the country. I think it's played a negative role with so much highlighting on the conflict.
Yeah.
As you said. So yeah, important to remember, we agree on most things. Let's keep the focus on making modest progress on the things that we agree on, and big progress on some of the big challenges, like this climate action can't wait.
Yeah.
I'm curious on, you had such a great insight that media has focused very much on conflict, and obviously you've got to cover it, but you could maybe change the context of it. You've talked about the 100 days in Appalachia of the regional efforts to give more nuance and texture to what's really going on the ground, and that some of the people locally in the Appalachia area are partnering with bigger news outlets to feed in stories. So it is a more complex, accurate picture of what's happening. What do you see as the future of journalism over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, I would say this, that if you asked me this question 2 or 3 years ago, I would have had a much more negative response than I will now, because I do think there is cause for hope right now, in the sense that we are seeing a lot of local outlets and certainly national outlets starting to get some momentum with paid digital subscriptions. You see, like, of course, the Times and the Post and the Wall Street Journal are doing really well with those. They're not going anywhere. But what we need is, we need to get that on a local scale. And I can report encouragingly that, you know, my own company, Gannett, which owns more than 250 newspapers throughout the country, is very optimistic about how their strategy is going. I'm not here to sing the praises of my company, just to say that there is a lot of progress. And if we, because, you know, digital advertising doesn't seem to really be working for local news, because you need an incredible amount of volume, and it just doesn't replace the money that you had from print. But digital subscriptions actually can be a lot more sustainable. And then also it can actually lead to much more nuanced and thoughtful content. Because when you're not as married to the need to maximize your page views, then you actually start to think a little bit more critically, I believe, about the stories that you should write, and to say, we can do maybe a little more public service journalism now because our readers are paying for it. And that can actually just sort of de-escalate the sensationalism. I'm not mentioning that just to say that overall, this is an issue that we continue to grapple with. And so we can't have a conversation about this topic and just blindly support journalism, which we need to support, without also saying there are ways we can improve.
Fantastic. That's very encouraging. And I would add, the Washington Post has been very strong now. People were worried with Jeff Bezos, right, like the richest guy in the world, taking it over, and what's he going to do? But it's been fabulous. It's really strengthened and hired more people, and done great coverage, I think. So there are some bright spots on the media landscape. And what can our listeners do? You know, you see all these great programs. What do you advise our listeners to? Obviously, the first thing to do, I would suggest, is read Nathan Boamy's book, The Bridge Builders, because that's really got tremendous amount of information that it's good to know of how to bring the country together. But specifically, like, what could listeners do to bridge the divide among Americans?
Yeah, I honestly think the very simplest, you know, basic suggestion I have is to get to know somebody who's not like you. You know, it's as simple as that. Actually, someone who thinks differently, prays differently, looks differently, you know, because we live in a segregated society, as I mentioned before, and it's segregated by politics, race, religion, all these things. You know, Dr. King said that Sunday morning was the most segregated hour in America. Maybe it comes down to attending some worship services with people who don't look the same as you do. Or maybe it comes down to joining a community group where you can serve the public together and meet people who aren't like you. I mean, I think there are ways not stay in our isolated corners, just tapping away in social media. You know, I think there are ways we can do that, because those relationships are the way that we can start to undermine this crisis of toxic polarization.
That's great. And what a great way to end a wonderful program. That is all the time we have. Nathan Boamy, author of Bridge Builders, thank you so much for being with us today and for your wonderful work.
So glad to be here. Thank you so much.